shortly we expect to be talking to Professor Tiffany Dixon, who is in political science at Oregon State University, and she is joining us now. Are you there, Tiffany Dixon?
Hi, Phil.
Hi, thank you for joining us. I'd like to talk to you about two big subjects here today. First, I'd like to talk about, of course, the situation that's unfolding in France, this crisis. And then in the latter part, I want to make sure we get into your thoughts on the accomplishments or lack thereof of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which is winding down. I think it's practically done. We can put a fork in it, as they say. But first of all, France has gone through quite a trauma, and you, of course, are trained in law. You've practiced international law. Following these events, what kind of things are you concerned about? What interests you, tracks you most in what's unfolding there, as a lawyer, law professor,
I'm sorry.
Take any title you like.
Yes, former lawyer. It's very hard to isolate rational thought in this particular matter. Like many people, this came as a shock. I have memories of some of these individual cartoonists from childhood, so that makes it a bit more complex. But a more legal approach or a more political approach causes me to be very interested in what appears, despite the massive coverage, constant wall-to-wall coverage, the lack of a serious investigation. Now, it's always difficult to conduct a serious investigation when you haven't arrested individuals, mm-hmm. and that they're gone. They're dead.
Yes, almost all the particular players were killed, right? The two men, the first, the ones who went to the offices, apparently, of Charlie Hebdo, and then the other man who had taken prisoners at the kosher grocery, they're all killed. There's no one else in custody at the moment, are there? Is there? Charged with this offense?
No one is currently charged with this offense. The wife of Amedi Koulibaly, who held those hostages at the kosher grocery, is allegedly in flight, would have gone to Syria via Turkey a few days before the events. French television has shown a grainy black and white picture, allegedly, of her with another individual clearing customs in Istanbul. But what? One of the wives of the Kouachi brothers had been held for questioning. She was released and cleared and condemned the attacks and said that she had absolutely no idea that her husband was even interested in this type of thing, let alone that he would accomplish such acts. Mm-hmm. And we have a bit more information because, as it turns out, when the brothers were holed up in a printing press, so 2 days after the carnage at the offices of Charlie Hebdo, one French news station, it's a 24-hour a la CNN French, kind of pretty right-wing and contributes a lot to creating the kind of climate I know we're going to discuss subsequently. So they actually called the press, and one of the brothers picked up, astonishingly, and so they got an exclusive interview with him where he told them that this operation was financed by Anwar al-Awlaki, that he met in Yemen, and he was asked when, and he answered, well, before he died, which is logical, of course. Mm-hmm. Then there's a final assault, and so that's what we know. Similarly, Koulibaly, who's holding the hostages in the kosher supermarket, called the same 24/7 news station, and they said, because apparently he was looking to get in touch with the police.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a number for that. Here it's 911, but mm-hmm. in Paris it's just two digits. It's 17. But in any event, he calls them and grants them an interview in which he says he is working on behalf of ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we know. And I mean, interestingly, and what's a little bit frustrating is when you get to, you know, what we expect to be more reliable sources of journalism, typically,
mm-hmm.
Like the New York Times. I read a front page below the fold article on Friday. But you have to turn the page before there's a single source mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the allegations was that this younger brother traveled to Yemen on his older brother's passport.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew this on the say-so of quote-unquote authorities. So this is all very, very frustrating because
yes.
we're short on facts. And we're really long on nauseous opinions.
Yes.
We have a prime minister of France who's announced that there's an enemy of the interior. An enemy of the interior, that's really going to improve the climate. We have a president who had popularity numbers in November of 12%, mm-hmm. Shot up today to 40%. So none of this smells particularly good.
So we may be seeing more medals and uniforms and marching around. It sounds like a formula to recover a political career. What about the actions, a very heavy action of beginning to arrest people for a curious charge? One is condoning, which it must be condoning terrorism. Terrorism itself is a rather difficult thing to be clear about in legal terms, but then you say condoning it. Give us your thoughts about that.
Well, that's astonishing, and I mean this began as a legislative project last fall that was developed and defended by the socialists. So I repeat, this is a project of the socialists in power. This wasn't done under Sarkozy.
Yeah, the two rather resemble each other at the moment, don't they? I wouldn't be able to tell them apart, actually, on this issue.
No, on this issue, you cannot tell them apart except that the socialists have gone further than the right-wing UMP. Why? Because the right-wing UMP had an opposition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys don't really. They're pretty much serving the UMP and the right what they want on pretty much every kind of policy. And you know, if I can just permit myself a little parenthesis, today President Hollande, just to show you how close they are to the right, said the labor unions ought to maintain the spirit of national unity that now animates France.
What's he talking about? Why does he have to specifically mention labor union?
Unions should be nice. This is not a time to be striking. This is not a time to be making demands.
Yes.
This is a time to honor our heroes.
Yeah, there's a war on. Everybody work and for less.
Yeah, but back to the question of these new laws. They were adopted in November. Something strikes me as very curious from a legal perspective. There is an offense of inciting terrorism, and we know there's, you know, inciting murder or incitement even to genocide that we've seen at the ICTR and at the ICTY. But this condoning terrorism mm-hmm. carries a higher penalty than actual incitement. That strikes me as illogical from a punishment perspective, if only that incitement is a graver offense
than simply
going on Facebook and saying, well done, lad.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, they used to use that expression, you know, the one who yells fire in a theater that's a crime. Well, certainly, that's what the analogy is, incitement. So if someone says, I don't mind fires. That's a different kind of crime or a different outlook. By the way, people are being arrested. I read actual mainstream press accounts of individuals. One man was intoxicated and had an accident, and he was angry with the police, and he said something complimentary about what had happened to Charlie Hebdo, and he was arrested. And if I understand it, they've already convicted him, and he's looking at 3 years.
Yes, yes. So the sanctions can carry up to 7 years in this condoning terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is if internet is used.
Yeah.
If it's just a verbal statement, it's 5 years with a maximum five
It's interesting
years.
They've managed to measure it. Somebody sat around and chewed his pencil and thought of the difference. A very serious matter I want to make sure I ask you about. That is the question of mosques, Muslims, particularly the Algerian community, I guess the North African community of Paris. There are many commentators that say that they are really under a kind of siege. Now, you, of course, have spent a lot of time in France. As a matter of fact, I believe you're a member of the Left Party of France. So you have some knowledge. What do you make of that? Are you hearing any, what is kind of crisis are they facing?
Well, they're facing a serious crisis, and it's been ongoing. I mean, before this, but just less frequent. We have some 50, I think it's up to 54 attacks on mosques. You have vandalism, throwing stones, fires. But, you know, an oldie but a goodie is throwing a pig's head in the grounds. Of course, the French Muslim North African community is experiencing, tremendous insecurity. And I've heard some accounts, some concern with respect to double standards.
Mm-hmm.
So as of...
Well, I think in previous conversations, I think you mentioned to me something which I was shocked by. You say that their prison conditions, those would be, that is, France, and which has a majority Muslim population in the prison, are the worst in Europe. Did I get that right?
Yeah, so the matter of the numbers of Muslim population detained in France is very tricky because the French state doesn't keep ethnic or religious statistics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's part of hardcore secularism.
Well, do they do it by ethnicity? Do they say?
No, they do not. They do not. So these numbers initially came from an article in 2008 in the Washington Post, where the journalist consulted with some chaplains and tried to come to an estimate. There has been a report done by a French sociologist of some four prisons, and his estimate has a range of from 50% to 80%.
Hmm.
But that's based on 15%.
And the conditions themselves are remarkable.
So the conditions are desperate, and you know we can go back to this particular event where Sherif Kouachi and Amedi Coulibaly met is in a notorious jail. It's the biggest in Europe. It's called Fleury-Mérogis. It's now holding double its capacity. It's been sanctioned by the European Court of Human Rights on several occasions. And in fact, Coulibaly was one of the detainees who smuggled out a video showing these disastrous conditions, sinks falling apart or destroyed, mold, rats. There have been challenges even articulated by the Union of Prison Guards concerned about asbestos that went into building this facility. And so there have been ongoing renovations, but they're still twice the capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And they're extremely short on Muslim chaplains. So that's part of the conversation today is, you know, would it help to actually have some kind of structured Islam? And structured anything else, by the way, because several reports say that large portions of the detained community don't have access to sports, don't have access to fresh air, or in conditions that are insufficient. And, you know, contrary to European human rights law.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and by the way, the government is running in the opposite direction. You just mentioned a union that is concerned about asbestos, and you have a president calling on unions to show solidarity with him.
That's not a
troubling combination, isn't it?
Correct.
There are some parties there speaking up. Is the Left Party and others are they addressing these urgent matters that you're talking about?
Well, in terms of prison reform.
Yes, and in fact, I guess those. There is a word for these North African communities that are around the city of Paris. Somebody's got to do something about those conditions. Does anybody plan to do any, have any kind of program?
No, absolutely. I certainly the Green Party, the Left Party, the Communists, Front de Gauche. I mean, one of the most important issues right now is housing. And the revitalization of communities that have been effectively abandoned by the state, in which there used to be, you know, in what the French called the 30 glorieuses, those 30 glorious years after World War II, when there were actual social programs and where, you know, housing was designed to be humane, human playgrounds.
Part of the four freedoms we all fought for.
Exactly. and not just social workers, you know, activities for kids. You know, a Republican school that encourages children and not excludes them, not punishes them, and you know, that's definitely these are budgetary considerations. Mm-hmm. And the socialists currently in power made those promises in 2012. They just haven't gotten around to it.
Yes.
Because they're too busy pushing laws restricting freedom of expression and breaking apart the labor code.
Maybe they should call themselves the former Socialist Party.
The Prime Minister has said that he doesn't think it should be called the Socialist Party anymore.
Ah, well, it's a growing trend. We know something about that in Canada. So this, we're happy to say, is T. Fan Dixon, professor at Portland State. I might have misstated. I think I had you at Oregon State, but I bet you prefer to be Portland. And by the way,
there's a kind word for the Algerians. You should know that FINEC beat South Africa in the African Cup of Nations 3-1. So there's a lot of happy honking going on in Paris and Marseille and many parts of France right now.
Ah, well, that is important. Thank you. Now, on the matter of the International Criminal Tribunal, of which you are one of the first lawyers to practice there, and you, of course, have written about this extensively. You've become an authority in international law, and there have been we've been through the period of this ad hoc tribunal, and it seems to be dying. I guess we'll call it a natural death. It will probably disappear this year, and people are evaluating it. Ed Herman has written a couple of books on the subject, he and David Peterson, the last one being Enduring Lies. And Michael Collins has a new book from, I believe is it Cambridge Press? A very, very distinguished press. It has an introduction by none other than yourself, actually. There's some chiming in from these, of course, are criticisms, these books, largely. There's been now a voice is raised saying, well, it's been a great success. And a gentleman named Alex Obote Obdora, who has some title within the prosecution, has said it was very fair, and that allegations that the ICTR was victor's justice are not well-founded. What's your take on the ICTR and whether or not it was victor's justice?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's the shiniest legacy around. And I think the ICTR is going to be remembered much in the way the Tokyo Tribunal was.
People forget there was one, don't they? Because it was so ugly.
It was definitely an ugly, and as you know, dissenting Judge Powell wrote, I mean, it was an exercise in neocolonialism. That may end up being the similar legacy of the ICTR. As far as fairness is concerned, I would love to make some mealy-mouthed balanced expert, but I practiced as a defense counsel. Mm-hmm. My experience wasn't one of any kind of fairness. It was sort of daily, hourly, every 10-minute hostility by the bench. Mm-hmm. I wondered why it was necessary to have the prosecutor at all. The litany of unfairness and violations of due process would go well beyond the time left in this show, and indeed, your successors, plural. I don't think it's correct to make that claim. And on the question of Victor's justice, Herman and Peterson have made very clear what they mean by that. They mean that no one from the RPF, mm-hmm. from the Rwandan side, that the UN Special Rapporteur had committed crimes under the jurisdiction of the tribunal were ever tried, period. So when they say only Hutus, with one exception, that is Italian George Ruggio, who was with mm-hmm. Radio Milcolin,
mm-hmm.
No one else has been tried, and it's not going to happen, obviously. Mm-hmm. So Obote Odora says that that's only partially true. I don't see how that's only partially true. And actually, if I may, mm-hmm. this text that ran in the London Evening Post is just, it's egregious. I haven't read something this inaccurate and this dishonest mm-hmm. since the 90s. I mean, mm-hmm. This is an unbelievably desperate attempt to warp the truth and to put words in the mouths of Herman and Peterson that they never expressed.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is it's pathetic, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it came under a title which I really hope that people will note, and I. It was basically the title said that that the event, which all prosecution, defense, everyone agreed, it was the spark for the genocide of Rwanda, was the shooting down of the plane, and defense, of course, kept raising this issue in court, and you were the first to do it, actually, in my memory,
yep.
And the prosecution always deflected and hid and et cetera. But he goes a little further than they used to go. He says that if the plane was shot down by the RPF, as many, I'd say most now, speculate, that it wouldn't have been a crime against, a war crime, or pardon me, a crime against humanity, I guess. It wouldn't have come under the jurisdiction of the ICTR. What did you make of that when you read it?
My head shot back like whiplash, and I made little squinty eyes.
Mm-hmm.
What is he even talking about? I mean, he builds an argument, but it makes no sense. And he draws it out, and it doesn't improve in subsequent paragraphs. So the argument is this, an investigation on the shooting down of the plane hinges on whether it's a military objective. And then he goes on to enumerate who was on the plane, President Habyarimana,
mm-hmm.
Who's commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the chief of staff of the armed forces, etc. So there are people with some connection to the military. Therefore, it's a legitimate military target, and therefore there's nothing else in terms of the Geneva Convention or any other jurisdiction of the tribunal. But I want to say, dude, there was a ceasefire in place.
Mm. And a legal political process, right?
Well, absolutely illegal and political.
Mr. Habyarimana was sharing power with the prime minister, who was a part of the alliance with the RPF itself. And the RPF was in this new process equally.
Exactly. But the very idea that shooting down the plane would not be under the jurisdiction of the tribunal is, I mean, it's beyond it defies restrained comment, to be honest. And, you know, he makes the further claim that no legal expert, I believe are the words, all legal experts would probably agree that no crime was committed. Well, that's very interesting, because Michael Horrigan, who's been on your show, James Lyon, formerly of the FBI, certainly did think and were requested by Judge Goldstone to undertake an investigation into the shooting down of the plane.
That is to say, his own chief prosecutor, yes.
Precisely because it was under the jurisdiction of the tribunal. It's Article 4 on the violations of Article. I mean, I don't want to start. I don't want to start boring your listeners with legalism. But I mean,
it's nice to know you could do it if you needed to.
Exactly, but murder and terrorism are both included under common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention.
Well,
so
go ahead,
there is a legal basis, and no, not all legal experts agree with this person who is currently consulting expert, which, as far as I know, means that you're not currently gainfully employed.
Yeah. It's sort of expert in waiting. This is Tiffany Dixon, professor at Portland State University, and of course tried cases at the ICTR, and you are again a witness to something which we really need to elaborate on, which came up in the correspondence between Mr. Ed Herman and Peterson and this man Obote, and that is the case of Jean Kambanda, the prime minister serving who took. Became prime minister following the assassination of Habyarimana. And he is listed as two things about him. Louise Arbour, who was the chief prosecutor at the time you were practicing there, and others have said that the conviction of John Kambanda was the most significant accomplishment of the ICTR. And that it just touches on the issue of proof of that there was a conspiracy. Again, I'll remind our listeners that Tiffany Dixon of Portland State actually was the first lawyer, defense lawyer, to encounter Mr. Kambanda. So, tell us about the Kambanda case and why maybe they have misrepresented the facts.
Yeah, that's okay, painful trip down memory lane there. So Jean Kambanda was arrested in a July 1997 operation in Nairobi. They called it NAKI for Nairobi Kigali. All these accused persons were brought back to Arusha. They actually managed to pick up an extra person who was a case of mistaken identity and ended up staying in jail for 2 months. And never appeared before the court, but that's another story. And Kambanda, and it's kind of easy to figure things out when you're going to the jail every day to discuss with your client. What was interesting is that we quickly discovered that that Kambanda had only briefly been there, and had been in fact removed from the jail. And sent to a place we discovered subsequently was 500 kilometers away in Dodoma to reside, I guess, in the former country house of Mwalimu Nyerere. Mm-hmm. And subsequent to that, we discover, and this is an odd kind of...
Wait, by the way, I should say... This was not made known, right? This was a secret.
Yes, and I mean we're not making this up in any way. There's traces of what happened in exquisite detail in an Amnesty International report published in 1998, which is still on its website. It's called ICTR Trials and Tribulations, and they set out in tremendous detail how Jean Kambanda was held in an unspecified place of detention, but it gets worse. They detail how the judges of the tribunal write orders in which they state that he is being held in the detention center of Arusha.
They were deceived. Or said they were.
Well, yeah. I don't know that they ever said subsequently that they had been deceived.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that they were deceived.
Mm-hmm.
I was there during that time, and I certainly expended a lot of energy to ensure that word got up to them.
Mm-hmm. And what happened?
I was going to say what happened is that Judge Pillay got promoted to High Commissioner for Human Rights at the United Nations. But I think you want to know what happened to Kambanda.
Yes.
Kambanda waived his right to counsel. He ended up staying 3 months with these police officers, one of whom is an ex-Quebecois provincial police officer that I had encountered accidentally because he was quite famous for having fabricated or planted evidence in a huge, very famous trial that became known as the Maddox Affair, and he had even been charged in criminal court for a number of things, including suborning perjury of another fellow comrade police officer. He was acquitted for that, but there's a whole, huge commission of inquiry in Quebec that was ongoing at the time that he was interrogating the former prime minister of Rwanda, Jean Kambanda.
Mm.
And so unsurprisingly, at the end of the day, and that day stretching from mid-July 1997 to May 1st, Jean Kambanda arrives in court and pleads guilty to all charges with the lawyer who's just been assigned to him, who turns out to be a family friend of the prosecutor. I saw him at his first appearance regarding the waiver of right to counsel. And tried to inform him that it was essential and critical that he have counsel, that he have his counsel of choice. I was in contact with his counsel of choice at the time. But he appeared to me to be absolutely terrified.
Mm-hmm.
And did not want the assistance of counsel at that time.
Yeah. Now, after he made his plea, he then made a second plea that he be allowed to go on trial. But that was turned down, was it not?
Well, yes. Because the plea had been entered.
I guess it takes us back to the opening question about the quality of this ad hoc tribunal. This is a major, hideous event called the Rwanda Genocide involving the deaths of many thousands. And he's not allowed to go on trial so that we can hear witnesses and learn what happened and see it disputed in court as to the facts and have it adjudicated. But instead they say, no, you already pleaded, you're out. To me, that was always one of the shocking things. Why not go ahead and let's hear the evidence? When you plead guilty, nobody listens to any evidence, right?
Well, correct. And that is precisely what happens when an individual is held in an unknown place of detention without counsel for months. He was misled, obviously. I mean, he appeared to think that he could take this quote-unquote responsibility. My understanding is that Ken Banda thought, look, I was prime minister, I have a political responsibility, I'll do this. But on the other hand, let's have a trial in the interests of justice and indeed historical truth. So,
which should be one of the tribunal's jobs, one assumes. People want to know what happened. And if I could ask you, he did actually, I don't know if the world knows this, he actually eventually went into court and testified in major cases, such as that of Mr. Bagasora, the alleged center of all the bad guys, and he testified that Colonel Bagasora had committed no crimes that he was aware of.
That is indeed little known fact, and you know that should also play a role in assessing the legacy of this body. You detain a guy, you have your knuckles slapped by Amnesty International for violating international law. This guy is held by a police officer who's just been criminally charged of the most serious offenses against the administration of justice. He's misled. He pleads, obviously, if the police is your counsel, you're going to be misled. Doesn't get a trial, and in the end testifies in favor of some of the most well-known defendants. Mm-hmm. It's not looking like a very sterling body.
If that was the high point for the work of the ICTR and Louise Arbour and Mr. Goldstone, etc., it's not a very high point in the view of, I would think, of others. Tiffen Dixon, Portland State University, thank you very, very much. We really appreciate the time, and it has been most edifying. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Tiffen Dixon, Portland State. And I think we have maybe 1 minute left. I'll remind you, Jeff Halper is coming Tuesday and Wednesday, first at the Brewer Street United Church, and then Wednesday he will be at Betsatoon, both of them at roughly 7:30. And go and make a big donation, because he, of course, is trying to finance his work, trying to prevent the destruction of housing in the West Bank and elsewhere. Now, there's something you should know. We've, of course, spoken out on this program for the Cuban Five. There's a wonderful photograph of several members of the Cuban Five holding in solidarity the flag of Syria. And Syria is fighting for its life at the moment against terrorists. I know Mr. Hollande feels vulnerable, but the governor of Syria has armloads of terrorists that have been shipped in through Turkey, paid for by Saudi Arabia. And I was very heartened to see that photograph. I think it has probably already been posted on our website, taylor-report.com. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And I want to thank Lucas, and Phil Connor will be with us next week again. And so we'll see you then.